Welcome everybody to On Pool Deck. We've got a special guest in today. We've got Hunter Jones from Underwater Hockey. So welcome, Hunter. Thank you for joining me on Pool Deck.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
Now, we're going to go through a few things today. Most people sort of know what hockey is, field hockey, ice hockey. Not a lot of people are sort of into the underwater hockey or what might be brand new into this. So we're going to delve into your world in underwater hockey. We're going to sort of talk a little bit about some of the equipment that you use, some of debunking some of those myths that people might have as a pool manager saying you can't do this because of X, Y, Z. So we'll sort of go through all that as a bit of a topic in that today. So, but before we sort of get into the underwater hockey, maybe give us a little bit of history about you. You know, sort of how did you get into the realms of underwater hockey? Why is it that you're so passionate about this?
Yeah, sure, Steve. Thanks again for having me. And yeah, basically about 10, 11 years ago, I began spearfishing when I was in primary school. And when I started getting into it and I really loved it, I wanted to get better. And the guy that taught me, he played underwater hockey and he was amazing diver, free diver, not on scuba. Yeah. And basically he said that to get really good at it, you got to get the fitness up. And the best way to do that is through underwater hockey. And he's actually a world champion of the sport and pretty good. So he got me into it and taught me. And then, yeah, I just couldn't believe how fun it was. And I've never stopped playing. So yeah, 10 years later, still cracking it. It's great.
So were you a swimmer before this? Were you into sort of swimming as a recreational or as a sport?
Yeah. I used to do quite well at the swimming carnivals at school. Before I did underwater hockey as well. I used to love it.
Yeah. What was your specialty?
I was backstroke.
You're a backstroke guy?
Didn't win any other races, just backstroke.
Yeah, and did you go on to do any representation or anything like that?
I think I did a couple of school carnivals, inter-school carnivals, into early high school, but then,
And what about open water? Did you get into any surfing or anything like that?
A bit of surfing, body surfing. Love going down just to City Beach and just going for a bit of a body surf. But nothing too hectic, no big wave surfing.
So you've always been grown up in the realms of in and around water and those sort of passionate things. That's fantastic. All right, so maybe give us a description about what your role is with underwater hockey. What do you do?
Yeah, so it's changed over the last year, but at the moment I'm part of Perth Underwater Hockey and I'm on the special projects committee person. Mm-hmm. And basically when there's pools we want to get into or getting new gear or looking into just anything just new to the sport really and growing it, I'm basically just forerunning that and making sure that it goes ahead and keeping the ideas flowing.
Maybe give us a little bit of history about underwater hockey, maybe where it began, sort of, was it here in Australia, was it overseas? What's the history behind it?
Yeah, so it's speculated to start in England, and I'm pretty sure that's where it did start, but they say the Navy divers, in winter when it was really cold and they couldn't get outside, they used to push dive weights off their weight belt on the bottom of a pool with sticks.
Yep.
And then it just slowly developed into a bit more, and now you wear a glove and a stick like that, but then, started in England, and now it's played in over 40 countries around the world, and some countries have it in their schools, like New Zealand and France and Turkey get paid to play, and it's getting bigger and bigger every year.
Okay, so it is getting a professional sport where people are starting to get paid and sponsorships.
Yeah, in Southeast Asia, they got the underwater hockey into the Southeast Asia Games, so it's got the Commonwealth Games equivalent, so that's probably the first big step for underwater hockey at the moment, that's the vision for the sports owners is to get into that multi-sport sort of competitions.
Yep, so it's at that sort of world championship. It's not an Olympic sport just yet?
No, unfortunately, no.
But is that something that the industry is trying to strive to work towards?
Yeah, that's the ultimate aim, I think. Yep. But at the moment, we're just setting our sights at Commonwealth Games level and those sort of events, world championships and stuff like that, where we can be a part of a group setting rather than just being underwater hockey world championships. It can be a bit bigger than that. So.
Yep. So where was the last one? You said Southeast Asia was the last. Was it World Champion or was that Southeast Asia?
So that was the SEA Games, Southeast Asia Games. The last World Championships was in July last year in the Gold Coast, actually.
Is it in the Gold Coast?
Yeah, I went there with the Australian team, yeah.
Yeah, that's excellent. So you have represented Australia in the underwater hockey. Maybe give us, for those who are a bit novice in this sort of area, we see American hockey, with the big sticks, obviously you'll sort of go through a little bit more about the equipment that they use, but give us a bit of a rundown on what makes up the rules what's your objective? What do you need to do in underwater hockey?
So you've got a puck. So it's a lead puck covered in soft rubber and a harder slider on one side. Okay. And you push that around the pool. And it's a 25-metre pool by 15 metres, and the puck starts in the middle. There's two goal trays on either side.
Yep.
You've got six players in the water, and the objective is to put the puck in the opposite team's goal tray.
Yep. So that is what, just 1 point or one goal?
Yeah.
So how long are the halves, or do you have quarters? What's the process there?
Yeah, there's two halves. It's a 30-minute game, 15-minute halves. Both teams get two timeouts, so one each half, and they're just like 2 minutes. And yeah, that's it though. So it's very high intensity, very quick game. It's all over and done with within an hour. Even the longest games, with overtime and stuff like that, the scores are drawn.
Yep. And now, what about refereeing? Obviously, they can't hold their breath for long periods of time. Give us a rundown of how they referee these sorts of games.
Yeah, so there's three referees, sort of like AFL. They surround the players and the ball or the puck, and so they can see from every direction. They're in the water with us. They're wearing the same stuff as us, like flippers, mask, snorkel, speedos. They have a protective glove on their hand so they can grab the puck if need be.
Mm-hmm.
If they need to call up a foul, obviously you can't hear people talking underwater.
Mm-hmm.
So they put their hand out of the water and they wave it. And then there's an out-of-water ref as well, and he has a button clicker that turns on an underwater speaker.
Right.
So when they sees that hand come up, he clicks the button and goes brr, 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 underwater, and then everyone comes up. That's it's a foul.
There's two referees, you said. One's out, one's in.
Three in the water and one out of the water.
Three in the water and one out. And do they rotate around at all? Or?
Not really. It's like they call the out-of-water ref and in-water refs. So the out-of-water ref normally stays the same for most of the competition. And then the in-water refs, they constantly rotate because you can't stay in the water all day.
Yeah.
If a competition, there's 20 games in a row, you're going to get cold.
Yeah. And so with the purpose of the three, does that mean that you're making sure that there's always a referee under the water at one period? So they alternate? How does that sort of work between the three of them?
It's hard. I'm actually not a referee myself. Yeah. A lot of countries, if you're going to represent them, you have to have been a referee before, so people know the rules and are accustomed to it all.
Yeah.
In Australia, a little bit slack on it. so I'm definitely not the right person to answer it, but I'm pretty sure they have three just so they can get an angle. Not necessarily have to be on the bottom. You can kind of see a lot from the surface. So I think it's just the angle. So you can, if someone's blocking at this side, you can still see it the other side.
Yep. So do we use underwater cameras at all? So either just for the sport itself or to adjudicate some of those rulings? Or how does that work?
Yeah, the cameras aren't used to do any reffing as of yet. But it's one of the hardest things at underwater hockey is to get it viewed. So at the moment we have like a camera on a ratchet strap sort of thing, and it has rollers each end, like electric motors, and it rolls the camera up and down, sort of like for swimming, had that like running camera underwater.
Yep.
Very similar, but it runs across the edge of the pool, so you can see the game from that camera. But when the player's on the other side of the pool, it can be hard to watch. So it's, that's one of the...
So is it under a remote control thing, so you can actually go up and down and that with
So there's a control room, So there'll be three or four people in there with two courts going, two camera setups, and they have people in there that control the camera, moving it. The camera can slide across, and they can also toggle inside of the underwater case as well.
Excellent. So what are the minimum requirements? So if somebody wanted to introduce underwater hockey, what sort of pool environment and that do you need to actually play?
So minimum requirements is pretty easy. Like, so not, almost any bottom you can play hockey in, unless it is a really abrasive, hard bottom. So we call abrasive is like the non-slip tiles you can get installed in pools nowadays. They are unhockeyable. It just rips your
skin. That's more so for the sliding of the puck, is it?
Or it's more the actual people get, they just get grazes.
Right.
Because you're swimming very fast, and if you scrub on the bottom, it actually takes a bit of skin off.
Yep.
But, concrete pools, lino pools, tile pools, they're all acceptable. Depths from 0.5 metres to 3 metres is generally what you'll use and be happy with. But for a national standard or international standard pool, it's got to be 2 metres to 3 metres deep. It's going to be 25 by 15.
Okay, 25 by 15. So it all obviously has to be flat bottomed, and that so it can't have any inclines or anything.
Yeah,
it'd be a bit
that's
unfair.
For nationals though. But a lot of clubs play in a slanted pool or in very shallow pools or deep pools, just whatever you can't get your hands on.
Yeah.
But then there's normally always, for a competition, it's dead flat, 2 metres deep. Yeah.
So how many clubs are there in Perth that are currently doing underwater?
In Perth, there is two clubs, two main clubs.
Yep.
But then there's quite a lot of regional clubs as well. So we've got Margs, Collie, Bunbury, Busselton and Karratha.
All right, so we've got more regional sort of people doing underwater hockey rather than the metro area.
Yeah, it just seems to catch on. Like Tasmania's got a really good club as well. I don't know why. The smaller, you know, communities seem to do really well. A lot of the city communities like Melbourne and Sydney and Perth and that. Gold Coast is doing very well, but those other ones, Sydney, Melbourne, Perth, we're struggling a bit. I don't know why. It just seems to just work better when you've got a bit of a smaller environment, but yeah, one of those struggles we're
working. So out in those regions, they've got a couple of teams. Obviously, you need to compete against somebody. It's not just one team out in the regional areas, is it?
Well, most of those regions, they kind of do have, they have like one club that has like lots of different players. They can group them into different grades. But yeah, it's not like normal sports where you have, you know, North Beach versus Scarborough or something like that. It's not, you don't quite get that underwater hockey yet. It hasn't quite reached that level.
Numbers. Hopefully we can promote that a little bit to get those sporting things happening. What about nationally? What you know, you mentioned a few sports and that, or a few teams and that. So is this something that looks like it's growing, you know, in the eastern states and here?
Oh, for sure, yes. East Coast, they've had lots of success getting lots of pools built specifically for underwater hockey. So getting the tile markings done on the bottom and everything, which is very special. So they've grown exponentially over the last few years. Just with the extra pools, they can get extra clubs and get the inter-club games. Yep. But yeah, overall, I think there's 600 and something players that do competitive hockey, so at nationals. Mm-hmm. But then when you look at social, there's many more, but you just can't count them all because each club does their own thing, and for me to find those numbers would take forever.
For sure. So we've gone through the requirements of what a pool would have to be. Maybe run through and give us a bit of a description for those who are just listening on the podcast and not able to view it. You gave us a brief thing of the puck. What's the glove for? What's the purpose of the glove?
Yeah, so the glove, it protects your hand from the bottom, other sticks, and the puck. Right. So the puck still weighs 1 kilo, and if it gets flicked, so they can actually, with their stick, they can actually launch the puck underwater, and it can fly quite fast if you're a big, strong person. It hits your hand, it's going to hurt really a lot, and between the tiles, there's grout lines and all that sort of stuff, and that just hurt, it just gets your, it really wreck your skin, you know, so you got this nice silicon-made glove, and it's got lots of protection. Like if you want to have a feel, it's very thick, and it just basically protects your hand from anything that hits it because it's in the play.
You know, waterproof and all that sort of stuff. Well, water resistant to all the material that thing. So that was actually a lot heavier than I think. I've just picked up the puck, that's what it is called. It is called a puck.
So
just like the other sort of ice hockey, I suppose. Whereas obviously field hockey is a ball. It is obviously needs to be staying on the bottom. The fact that you can say that this does fly, you think I can see the weight of it, you know, if it is flung pretty fast through the water, it would certainly hurt if you got hit with it. So what's the purpose then of the referee having a glove as well?
So if the play continues on and no one can, the buzzer, because sometimes there's two courts in the same pool and the buzzers get mixed up and people keep playing, so they'll jump in there and grab the puck sometimes.
So it's just more protection for them as well.
Yeah, and like sometimes when you go to a sanctioned event, like a big nationals or worlds, they won't wear a protective glove. They'll just wear an orange glove or something so you can see it coming in. But yeah, it's rare they'll throw their hand in there because they don't want to get hit. But at a social game, they'll wear a glove because they want to grab it.
So it is certainly, it sort of looks like, a motorcyclist or something would wear something with some padding and that in and around those for those sorts of things as well. It's not like a Michael Jackson glove where we're talking with all glittery and sparkly and so forth. But maybe give us a bit of a description about your actual, the stick itself, you know.
So yeah, so the stick
quite small.
Is... Yeah, it's smaller than you'd think. It's only, but less than 30 centimetres. Yeah. Most sticks sit around that. 200 to 250 mil mark. There is like limits and everything to how big a stick can be and how wide and thick and all these things. But generally they're made out of plastic and wood. Wood was the old school way, where they used to actually call the game Octopush. They actually had, their bat was more like a big Y, letter Y, and they used to push the puck in the Y at the end. So they used to push around like this. Yep. And then it changed and now it's the puck's played in the front face of the stick where they can have a beveled edge and when they launch the puck can fly and you can pass the puck easier.
So for those who can't see it, it's basically what a field hockey stick would be, but in miniature size,
It's got a little hook and everything.
The little hook and that. So, all right. So Maybe give us a bit of an explanation about some of the challenges that you guys sort of face in the industry, you know, being a sport that you need obviously 25 metres, so it's a fair bit of chunk of water space that you need. What are some of those challenges you face?
Yeah, so as we were saying before, we needed 25 metres by 15, so that accounts to be like, you know, six lanes or, yeah, five, six lanes of pool space plus 25 metres long. So yeah, It does take up a fair bit of space. So we find a lot of pools getting space is like the kind of ends of the timing, you know, maybe towards the end of the day, so, you know, 6 o'clock onwards or stuff like that. Or a lot of pools, well, so they just don't have the space for us because, you know, people are booking lanes, everything, it just isn't enough room. Yeah. But then also, yeah, pools saying that they don't want us in there because they think we might be breaking tiles and wrecking their pool, which is definitely isn't the case.
Yeah, so that sort of gives us a bit of a segue into talking about some of those myths and that people, you know, some of the pool managers are out there, they may have had going off information that they had, you know, 20, 30 years ago, still thinking it's the same. But obviously, you know, some of the equipment has changed in the way it's designed and that. So it gives us sort of a progression in that to just debunk some of those sort of myths that they have out there.
Yeah, so the classic myth is that hockey will break your pool, break a tile, whatever it is. I brought in an old school puck just so you can see what it looks like compared to a normal puck. And for people that can't see, The old puck is just a chunk of lead.
Yep.
It's very similar to an ice hockey puck, but yeah, just made out of lead. So damaging, brutal, you know, you can only imagine the injuries that would have come out of it from just people playing.
Yes.
But that was, 30, 40 years ago, talking the 80s when that was happening.
So it is, like you mentioned before, the Navy SEVO is just like a weight belt, you know, the lead weight belt and that getting pushed around. And obviously, that would have been destroying it and that. But that's got an outer cover, hasn't it, on the newer one?
Yes, it's exactly the same inside, but then this very soft rubber outside.
Yep.
Like if I were to drop that on anything, it just goes boing and just kind of bounces. You know, there's no direct hit. It just slows everything down and stops that direct smacking of the tile.
Yep.
So that's one of the things that have changed. Also, sticks have changed. Now most of them are plastic. So back in the day, painted wooden bats, you know, you're touching it on the bottom, you're going to make marks. And we had our goal trays. They're 3 meters long and they weigh a lot so they don't move when you push pucks into them. They used to be made out of steel. Yep. And you can only imagine the damage that would do to a pool. Yep. So they got them out. We make fiberglass and plastic goals now. Okay. And they're still... there's no damage to the pool anymore. You know, they're very light. And
so is it like a PVC sort of material?
Yeah, exactly.
So
right.
Very similar to what, you know, the swim platforms and that are made of. Is it
very similar,
So again, you know, we're utilising them in the pools and not causing damage, but obviously, you know, getting that in and out and that, so a bit of risk management in that sort of process, and that is certainly obviously important.
There's lots of, it's still progressing. Like a lot of people, we haven't figured it out yet, that's for sure. And like you said, with the pool swimming platforms for kids swimming and all that, I'm sure they've got it pretty sorted out, but we just need to converse with the outer aquatic industry and get our processes, you know, really good, especially if pools have different types of pools where they need special requirements. You know, we're happy to bend to all the rules they want us to bend to, but we just got to get in there and give it a crack and let people see that hockey isn't as bad as they may think.
Now, the other sort of myth that we've come across, and you could probably give us a little bit more explanation on this, is around hypoxia and breath holding. Obviously, that's been a major concern for the industry, for pool managers and so forth, to have these types of, give us a bit of a rundown of some of the things you've come across and what sort of studies have been done out there.
Yeah, so, well, over my 10, 11 years of playing hockey, I've never heard of anyone ever passing out or being close to hypoxia or shallow water blackout. And I've talked around the world to a lot of different clubs and it's very, very rare. I've never heard of it ever happening. But that's only, 10 years of my life, so I can't use that as an excuse. But overall, they did a study over in America where they measured all the submersion times of all the players in many hockey games. Mm-hmm. So they did, as soon as a person went underwater, they'd start a timer, and when they came back to the surface, and they did it for the entire game. And what they found is that the average underwater time for hockey is 11 seconds, which is way less than professional swimmers. So it's if they were to classify hockey as more dangerous than swimming, I'd be surprised.
Because there has been some banter around that whether it's an extreme sport and I don't know what the classification of an extreme sport, but, you know, that, then we're starting to target things like free diving and that, where they're down for minutes at a time, rather than obviously what you mentioned there is an average of 11 seconds. Because a lot of other sort of sports would be in this realm. You know, you've got artistic swimming, which you've got to hold their breath underwater for periods of time. Underwater rugby is also another popular. Is that something that's, yeah, have you heard that that's getting quite popular here, or is that, you know, progressing as well?
Yeah, rugby's getting quite a lot bigger. It's very big in South America, in Colombia especially. They absolutely love it over there. Yep. And a lot of those Colombians have moved over to Australia. So the East Coast is, quite a lot of Colombians have come over and started clubs, and it is growing, definitely is growing.
So it's got some synergies there with underwater hockey and underwater rugby, just some slightly different rulings and that, and how it's played. And that's obviously, we just got to get two opponents. One's got to get, you know, the ball to the other end and so forth. But yeah, I have spoke to other people over East, and it is growing there as a sport. So that's hopefully that's something we can progress here as well as underwater hockey, as well as underwater rugby and all our other programs and that, that we have in our, in the aquatic recreation industry. So what sort of risk management sort of stuff as an organisation, what do you guys go through if you were to introduce another team or want to bring it to a facility? What sort of processes do you discuss with the facility and the managers there?
Yeah, well, our first discussion with them is about the pool, you know, making sure we're not going to break anything and make sure they're happy with what we're doing. Mm-hmm. So we go through all the gear and we show them exactly what you're using. Some pools are, you know, way less... find the word, like they don't care as much, but some pools are very, very strict on what they want to see. Mm-hmm. So we make sure all that's sorted, and then when we get to the safety side of things, we always have a lifeguard on duty anyway for our sessions. We have to normally get our own, but the good thing about underwater hockey is everyone's in the game, watching the game, everyone's underwater already, and that's sort of the best way to have it. If you ever get into freediving, their like rule is if you're testing your breath hold, because they do that a lot, you don't have someone on the side of the pool watching them. You've got to be in the water with them, and that's the only way you can kind of tell. So that's one of our, you know, risk managements, that we have lots of people around in the water and everything, so everything's being watched. There's no... The risk is very low. The hazard's always going to be there, but the risk of anything happening is, you know, is very low due to all the things we put in place.
So if anyone out there that was interested in maybe getting that into their facility, so underwater hockey, setting up a club or even just, you know, introducing it as a program into their facility, what do they need? Who do they need to contact?
So WA Underwater Hockey has their own webpage. There's an email address on there. If you want to get your pool into it, you just flick them an email and they'll look after you. They'll give you all the information you really need. Carnarvon's just done it recently. The pool manager up there, he came down and met us all, and we gave him lots of gear because we've got surplus gear. So when we hear of new clubs starting, we can almost always give them gear to get them started and then work out everything else later. So that's what Carnarvon's done, and he's just getting 20, 30 people down every few nights in Carnarvon, which is, for the pool there, is pretty great. You know, they don't always get lots of people in. So, yeah, it's worked out well up there. So, yeah, flick an email to the W Underwater Hockey page. That's probably the best way.
That's great. So we've covered a fair bit here today. We've gone through, obviously, the history of it. We've gone through some of the equipment that it requires and some of the requirements. Debunks, hopefully, some of those myths out there. So some of those pool managers out there that, you know, is, if that's the only thing that was preventing them of getting underwater hockey in, hopefully we just need to educate, you know, so the industry a little bit better to be able to get this. So I really appreciate your time. And that we'll put some links up on the podcast to underwater hockey and any other social pages and so forth. But thank you very much for joining us. Really appreciate your time. And thank you for joining us on Pool Deck.
Thank you very much, Steve. Cheers.